Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now we're in depth on money and politics, and here's what happened last time we talked about it.
If one suggests that money is just buying people outright, I don't think that's the case. Most interests tend to give money to representatives and,
it buys
and Congress
access.
Who already agree with them.
Doesn't
so it's
it buy
not like they're changing a lot of votes.
That's one of today's guests, University of Miami political scientist Joseph Yusinski, the last time he was on the show. And we thought his assertion about money in politics needed more discussion. I'm convinced that money buys access. If you give big, you get FaceTime, you get your calls answered, you get consideration from the politician in a way that average constituents just don't. Does my perception match the facts? That's part of what we're talking about this morning, and I'm interested in your ideas as voters about money in politics. We hear a lot about the influence of money in politics. What do you think that specifically means about the way your representative at the state or the federal level behaves? What concerns you about money in politics? Phone number here, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I've tweeted a question out on Twitter. It's at CarrieNPR. And Steph Curtis is hanging out in a discussion here at nprnews.org/live. Our guest today, Joe Yusinski with us. He's an assistant professor at the University of Miami. He's the author of a book titled American Conspiracy Theories, and he's with us from Miami. And Joe, good to have you back on the show.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
John Nichols joins us. He's a journalist for The Nation and the author of Dollarocracy and other books. And he's with us from Madison. Hey, John, welcome back to the show. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be with you and with Joe.
Joe, I'm glad we can come back to the conversation since, you know, we only played a little bit of it there in the introduction. I want you to flesh out more where money and politics intersect when it comes to influence. What's your thought on that?
Well, I agree with you, Carrie, that money can get people access sometimes, that doesn't bother me that much. But I think when we watch the campaigns and they talk about, you know, getting rid of the influence of money in politics, or how the 1% control everything, or the corporations control everything, or the Citizens United case, I think that sometimes the arguments that are out there are blown way out of proportion. I don't want to say that money doesn't cause problems in politics, and I don't want to make the assertion that everybody has equal access to all levers of government. There is no world in which we would all be equal.
So,
but with that said, I think we need to be very careful with the claims that we make, because sometimes saying, oh, well, money just controls everything, it's a way to scapegoat others for, you know, when things just don't go our way.
But Joe, I really want to understand, there's a spectrum of what you've just talked about. Yes, you say influence can be bought with campaign donations, but you don't think money controls everything. Well, how much influence do big givers have? Do they have the kind of influence enumerated in the introduction? They get their calls returned. They get consideration from the politician. They get FaceTime with the politician. Is that the kind of influence we're talking about?
Well, we have needed to disaggregate influence and access. Those are two very different things, right? Congress people will take calls from a lot of people, particularly if they're rich. And like I said, you know, people with money, you know, and there are different classes of people that can get access too. You know, I have access to my Congress people because I teach a big class and they want to come here and recruit my students to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I get access to Congress people in a way that other people wouldn't, right? So, yes, different people have different levels of access. However, that doesn't mean that I can call up my congressperson and get a vote changed. It doesn't mean that the NRA can give $5,000 to Nancy Pelosi and have her start supporting, you know, gun rights. It just doesn't work that way. A lot of times money just reflects what's already out there. John, you know, the NRA gives money to people who, to Congress people who are already going to vote their way. It doesn't buy off, you know, the Chuck Schumers and the Nancy Pelosi's.
John, when Joe uses those examples, I think he's using kind of the extreme that if you give a lot of money, you can call up and get a vote changed, that the NRA can sway Nancy Pelosi. But there's a lot of territory in between that, isn't there?
Of course there is. And, you know, Joe makes a reasonable argument for a point of view. And it is a part of our discourse. There are people who believe this. There are also folks who believe the parallel point of view that our politics is completely controlled, you know, totally corrupt. The reality is in the middle. The reality is, and the middle is, of course, the worst corruption of all. And that is an inequality of access, an inequality of influence. In the 2012 presidential race, when we charted all the money that flowed in at state, local, national levels, congressional races, referendums, primary contests, the whole thing, it's roughly around $10, $11 billion. That's an immense amount of money.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, but our pro-money in politics friends will tell us, oh, that's a drop in the bucket compared to advertising for stuff on TV. But that $10 or $11 billion comes disproportionately from wealthy people.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are Democrats. Some are Republicans. What they create, and this is the key to it, what they create is a politics that is disproportionately reflective of their values and their needs. Remember, big difference, values and needs. And one of the reasons that we have so much disenchantment with government today, remember I'm saying one of the reasons, not the only one, is a sense that we have a government that is unresponsive to the great mass of Americans. And there was a wonderful essay written a while back by, I think it was someone from the Sunshine Foundation, who said, you know, that sentiment, very commonly held, very commonly spoken in our politics, but isn't necessarily the sentiment of very wealthy people. Because the funny thing is that for very wealthy people, by and large, the current circumstance works extremely well for them. We have growing income inequality. We have a redistribution of the wealth upwards. And so what we've created is not something about the NRA, or not something about the hot-button issues that are so frequently discussed. It is about the kind of day-to-day life of this country, and it reflects the demands of very wealthy people rather than the needs of the great mass.
I want to take a call, and then, Joe, I'll come back to you on that, to Mike in St. Cloud. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. Great topic. You know, they told me to keep this brief, and I'll try. It's it's ludicrous to think that money doesn't buy influence and access. Why would anybody spend the kind of money that is spent on political action PAC committees and political campaigns if they didn't expect some kind of return on their investment? Look at what it costs to be a candidate. These people spend hours a day raising funds. That's what it's all about, money, 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 money. And if you didn't think that that money being spent couldn't be spent better on a charity or a nonprofit where you can actually pinpoint and focus where those dollars are going versus just, you know, blanketing these campaigns and candidates with millions and millions of dollars, Citizens United has destroyed the election process. And anybody that says that money doesn't have an influence, I have no idea what they're thinking.
Okay. So, Mike, there's a lot there, and I want to take it apart a little bit. I also want to play something that Donald Trump has said in 2015 before he was a presidential, about how he handled money and giving to candidates before he was a presidential candidate. Let's listen.
I give to many people. Before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them, 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them. They are there for me.
So what?
And that's
get?
A broken system.
So, Joe, that is Donald Trump during the debates, but talking about how he gave as a private citizen, to what he said and to what Mike said.
Well, let me take Mike's comment first. I mean, we could all make this red meat argument that the money on campaigns will be better spent on a charity. I mean, we could make the argument that any money any of us spends could be better spent on a charity. When I think about spending on campaigns, there is no better speech than political speech. So when we talk about the money that's given to campaigns or to the interest or to the groups that spend money on advertising during campaigns, that is sacred stuff. It's why we have the First Amendment. I mean, political speech is the highest form of speech, and we need to protect it. And I understand the argument that you don't like people spending billions of dollars to influence elections, but at the end of the day, the only thing they're buying is speech in those campaign ads. And you can turn it off. You can not pay attention to it. You know, so they don't buy votes and they don't buy elections. They buy speech. And
okay.
I will say that for the most part, they spend the money very poorly because a lot of times we don't see a lot of influence from the ads that they purchase.
So that's the campaign advertising. What about what Donald Trump says about this is how it worked for me and it worked pretty well because I'd give and 2 years later I'd need something and they'd take my call and they'd do it?
Well, if they're doing things because he gave them money in a quid pro quo, then that's you know, could very well be illegal, and those people should be prosecuted for it.
But you know that that's not how it works. It's not a quid pro quo. It's much more insidious kind of influence.
Well, what Donald Trump described is a quid pro quo, right? He said, I give them money, I call them, they do what I want because I gave them money. That's buying stuff. And that's you know, I believe that's illegal. If it's the case that somebody donates money and then has their call taken 2 years later, I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that. I would prefer that everybody have equal access, but given that access will always be unequal, this doesn't upset me that much.
John, a minute ago, you drew a kind of a bright delineation between influence and access. What's the difference in your mind?
Very easy. Influence is far more troubling than access. Okay? Both are troubling. Influence also is not just what Trump described. I mean, Trump would, if they took him into court, he would say, oh, I meant what I wanted was, you know, to vote for good and noble things, right?
Right?
So, I mean, there's always this way they talk around it. Influence is permanent. It's ongoing, and this is the key thing. Dick Durbin said a little while ago, or a few years ago, that bankers, and I hope I'm paraphrasing correctly, frankly, bankers own the place. He was talking about the U.S. Senate. He was trying to explain why even when you reform banking laws, you don't get real reform. You don't get anything akin to what the average American, what the average four-year-old would tell you is needed, and frankly, what the average retired banker would tell you is needed. And so we keep the too big to fail. We keep all these, you know, really damaging and dangerous approaches to our financial services. Well, why does that happen? Does it happen because a bunch of bankers flooded in the day before and gave money? Sometimes, you know, you can actually find those examples. But when you give permanently, when you're constantly giving, when a part of your budget for the year is to pour a whole bunch of money into politics, and you pour a lot of it into both parties, or perhaps one party if it's dominant in a certain situation, you're buying an influence that is definitional. And the fact is that the average person in America, the average working person in America, cannot buy their way into that process. It is a disastrous scenario. And it does two terrible things. One, it gives us bad governance. Governance is not reflective of the great mass of Americans on the less covered but day-to-day issues of governance. Two, it gives us a rotten politics. Our campaigns cost dramatically too much. As my good friend Joe is pointing out there, they waste immense amounts of money. And what we've done is we've created a politics now where so much energy goes into raising money from these influencers and then putting it on television, and we have literally deconstructed grassroots politics in much of this country.
Joe, I have one more example. John just talked about the banking industry and its influence in Washington, its consistent influence. I have another example of the pharmaceutical industry, which we are, I think, one of the few countries that does not allow negotiation for the lowest prices on behalf of Medicare with these pharmaceutical companies. Why is that? Isn't it because the pharmaceutical companies have the kind of consistent influence that John describes with the banking industry?
I don't doubt that big industries have influence on how they're regulated. But I think to blame the big industry is to miss a large part of the cause. You know, when we want something regulated, you know, what we're really saying is that that we want government to be in bed with those that they're regulating, because we know that whoever's going to get regulated will spend whatever it takes to lessen the impact of those regulations. And government knows that, and they love it. And that's why government's always happy to regulate new things, whether it's energy drinks or soda or anything. Right? They're happy to create new constituencies that then have to lobby them. So if we just say, oh, it's people giving money to the politicians who are, you know, angels but are just corrupted by this influence, I think we're missing a lot of it. And the same goes for our regulatory agencies. They often get co-opted, and they're in bed with the people that they're supposed to regulate. And, you know, you give one example about the pharmaceuticals. Yes, they should be able to bargain for cheaper prices. On the other hand, there's another recent example with the EpiPen. Why are EpiPens so expensive?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get mad at the people who make the EpiPen. Why not the FDA? They haven't allowed any competition to come in. You know, so they've left a monopoly for EpiPens with the manufacturer. Of course they're going to raise prices. It's a government-protected monopoly.
This is a conversation, if you've tuned in, about trying to understand the influence and the access that money buys in politics, taking care not to make big generalizations here this morning, parsing out just what it means when, as a big donor, you give to a campaign, what you expect for that, the kind of access you may get, the kind of influence overall over the long term you wish to wield, just where that influence begins and ends, where that access begins and ends. Joe Yusinski with us. He's an associate professor at the University of Miami. And John Nichols with us, a journalist for The Nation. And asking you for your views on this, I will come back to the Citizens United issue here that Mike, one of our callers, brought up, because I know there's a lot of concern and suspicion around that. I want to make sure that we understand just what role it plays in money and corporations and politics. But I'm also curious about what you think specifically money in politics, contributions, means for the way your representative at the state level or at the federal level behaves. What concerns you overall about money in politics? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Jill says on Twitter, as a patient advocate, I'm convinced that money is the reason insurance has so much control. It's called lobbyists. And to the phones to Peter in Minneapolis. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, how are you thinking about this?
Well, I think we're missing something in the question of, do they buy just, quote, access, or do they buy votes? The influence of money is in buying the lack of a vote, the lack of a hearing on an issue, the lack of a speech on the floor of Congress. Ask any lobbyist, even at our state capitol, and they'll tell you oftentimes their goal is not to pass legislation, it's to stop legislation from getting passed. And this is something you can't quantify easily, but that doesn't mean it's any the less real. Why do a particular industry, for example, donate disproportionately to the committee chair of the committee that regulates their industry?
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to buy inaction. They want to buy silence. And it's incredibly effective. It's incredibly effective at the state and federal level of government. And the fact that it can't be quantified doesn't mean that it's not huge. It's buying the agenda, which is even bigger than buying access.
John, is that a key part of the story that Peter brings up?
Of course, it gets to the heart of the matter, and this is what I mean by the permanent influence. Permanent influence seeks not merely to put items on the agenda. Remember, when we have massive income inequality, when we have absolute evidence of a redistribution of the wealth upward, when wages are stagnant for working people, but incomes are booming for millionaires and billionaires, right? You don't really want to change a lot of that. Why change it? Why not just maintain it? And so the way to understand contributions by an awfully lot of these folks is as, it's sort of like a maintenance payment. It's like, a little payment you make on your condo to keep it up or something like that. It's government works for them currently. And it creates the absolute absurdity of a circumstance like what we saw just a couple years ago, where the U.S. Congress, supposedly our representatives, was debating not whether to increase food stamps or programs for people that are hungry in America, but rather how much to decrease it. This was Democrats and Republicans, how much to decrease it. At the same time that they were debating how much to cut taxes for very wealthy people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll ask you, which one of those two items advanced? Cutting food stamps, cutting back on hunger programs, or cutting back on taxes for the wealthy? I can tell you that at the end of the day, when choices were made, cutting taxes for the wealthy and keeping tax breaks that had come in under the Bush era, they prevailed. This is the thing to understand. And if I can just add one quick other point as regards the regulatory issues, Joe's exactly right. I mean, the people that are regulated, the interests that are regulated, do develop sort of permanent influencing of those agencies. So the way to deal with that is to say, yeah, we have problems in our politics, we have problems with our regulatory systems, but we also have problems with a campaign finance system that allows that to happen. So rather than saying, well, we got this terrible problem and look at all these bad people that, are influenced by this money, why don't we go to the heart of the matter and say that the money is a huge, huge part of this problem. And decades ago, I knew Gaylord Nelson, the great senator from Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
He maintained a 9-year open hearing on drug prices in America in the 60s and the 70s. Nelson, during that time, meticulously refused to solicit campaign contributions from drug companies to know. In fact, he actually made it certain they didn't know, where his money came from in this regard for him, because he didn't want that precise influence. And as chairman of the committee, again, he wanted to be able to act, not be influenced. We need that sort of attitude. And yes, that's not just campaign finance. That is changing. As Joe suggests, that is changing the way that our political figures operate, but it's also in core recognition that the money is the crisis.
A call here, I think, that goes right to that, John, from Deborah in Staples. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. We wouldn't even need to have this conversation if we had public financing of campaigns like most countries do. Either we should have campaign financing reform, public campaign financing, because the media corporations are making billions of dollars off selling the airwaves that belong to the public. I think they should, the media corporations should sponsor public debates. They should give each candidate a certain amount of time to present their platform, like a public service announcement. Either have that or get rid of every member of Congress and let the people who are making the laws take the seats. I mean, the CEOs of drug corporations.
Oh, just put the lobbyists and the CEOs in there.
No, not the lobbyists, because the corporations would save, or Wall Street, the bankers would save tons of money. They're just using the lobbyists to do their bidding, and the Congress people are their lapdogs. So just get rid of Congress, get rid of lobbyists.
Okay, Deborah, I'm going to. I think you're making that recommendation a bit tongue in cheek. But here's what I want to put to Joe Yusinski. I thought she was going to talk about public financing of campaigns. Joe, is that the answer? I know there are some issues with that. In your view, would that address some of what we're talking about today?
It would address some of what you're talking about today, but let's not let's use the right term for it. It's not public financing. It's government financing.
Right.
Government will decide how much to take out of our pockets to give to people that they want to run for office. So it's taking a lot of control out of people's hands. And as much as we don't like the disproportionate influence of wealthy people or big, mean corporations, we should be equally wary of saying to the government, yes, you have the power to decide which candidates get to spend what and who gets to run. You know, so whatever faults we have in our system, we have a system that's largely free and safe from, you know, and I'm glad for Citizens United. I want less government control over political speech, because that's what we're really talking about in campaigns.
Joe, I want to ask you about a study, and I have a feeling you're aware of this. It came out in, I think, 2014, done by a couple of researchers at the University of California, Berkeley. And they just did kind of a simple experiment where they emailed congressional offices asking for a meeting. And when they mentioned that they were campaign donors, they got a meeting much more often than when they didn't. And here's what the study conclusion said. Members of Congress were more than three times as likely to meet with individuals when their offices were informed the attendees were donors, an over 200% increase in access. I think that really buttresses what John started out saying, was it, you get the kind of face time that you want if you are a donor that the average American cannot get.
Well, I'll give you another study, too. I mean, the system is, you know, does have some biases in it. There was another study done similar to this in a state legislature where they did the same thing, but instead of varying, you know, whether the person was a donor or not, they varied whether the person was African-American or not. And the African-Americans were less likely to get access to their state legislators than non-African Americans. So there's all sorts of biases built in, you know, towards donors. There's racial biases, all sorts of stuff going on there. And I would prefer that there be less of it. But again, what that study's talking about is access. Can they get an appointment?
Mm-hmm.
And that's different than getting a vote. So we want to, you know, we should be very clear. Congress people have X amount of time. And they have policy goals that they want to accomplish. In order to accomplish those policy goals, they have to get reelected. And in order to get reelected, they need money to fund the campaign. So, yes, you know, just as the other guest says, there is this bias built into the system. But, you know, where you and I were arguing last time I was on is that we want to be clear and very specific with what we're talking about. We want to be able to say exactly what is that influence, what does it do? And, you know, your last caller had some ideas about getting rid of Congress and getting rid of rich people. And, you know, the other guest right now is talking about, you know, if we limit campaign money, we would have different legislative priorities. I'm not necessarily sure that all that's so true. You know, corporations have money because they have a lot of people who are buying stuff from them and dependent on them. So that means that they have people who are going to go out and vote, right? You can imagine a representative in a district that has a big industry in it. Even if that industry didn't give money,
yes, they'd get
to that
meeting.
Representative, that representative still has to do stuff for that industry, whether it's in the public good or not, because they represent them.
John, now that we've had Citizens United in place for, what is it, 3 years? What?
No, it's actually, amazingly enough, six.
Wow, that's hard to believe. Yeah. Wow, yeah. 6 years. What do we now know about how things have changed under Citizens United?
Well, look, I think the important thing to understand is that Citizens United has become a catchphrase for a host of Supreme Court decisions, not just the Citizens United decision. Citizens United, there's plenty of documented evidence that it has opened things up, especially for corporate donors, not merely, you know, within the realm of Citizens United's purview, but beyond it, because people feel freed by the court. Essentially, the court has said, yeah, look, things aren't going to be as strict as they used to be. But I'll give you an example of what I mean by this, using Citizens United as a sort of a catch-all phrase. You go back to the Buckley v. Valeo decision in 1976, all the way through very recent decisions like McCutcheon, what you form is a pattern that essentially says, if you've got a lot of money, there's all sorts of ways where you can have a lot of influence. Now, Joe points out, he says, you know, if you represent a district where there's a large industry, if you're coming out of, you know, Detroit area, you're going to be interested in the auto industry. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a given. We understand that.
And it should be that way, that you're representing the concerns, shouldn't it?
It should be, of course. And it also should be that if you represent, you know, a district with a large African-American population, you should meet with the people from your district and not have bias there. But here's the interesting thing. The auto industry, of course, affects the whole of the country. The condition of African-Americans and others affects the whole of the country. So our members of Congress ought not simply be reflections of the district. They should, even if they don't have an auto industry or if they don't have a large minority population, they should be concerned and engaged. And here's where the kind of imbalance comes in, where things really start to fall apart. Under the McCutcheon decision, we knocked out a lot of barriers to somebody giving money in congressional districts across the country, just spreading money across the country to places where you don't have your industry, where, you know, you aren't resident. And what we've really ended up with is a situation now where people are pouring money into politics not to make sure that their local concerns or their local issues are heard. They're pouring money into politics to make sure that they maintain permanent influence over our politics and our governance. And here's where the big problems come in. The people are on to this. They get it. They understand. And this has had a very damaging impact on people's faith in politics, their faith in government, even participation levels. Remember, we're talking about other countries that have public financing systems or different systems for running their elections. There's a variable there that's pretty interesting if you want to measure, you know, what works. They have dramatically higher voter turnout. People participate in elections in countries like Germany and Norway, France, Britain, at much higher levels than the United States, because I think we really have created a circumstance in this country. It was never perfect, and I'm not saying campaign finance is the only factor in lower than necessary turnout. We've created a circumstance in this country where there's a tremendous number of people who simply say, you know, yeah, I'm not going to get access, but I'm also really worried about whether my vote.
Yeah, it's like that system is rigged kind of idea that we've heard about.
And interestingly enough, in both political parties, that phrase was broadly accepted this year.
A conversation this hour, if you've just tuned in, about the influence and the access and the true limits of what money can buy in campaigns and in politics. And that last thing that John Nichols, one of our guests from The Nation, was just talking about is something I want to turn to here for you as you listen in and as you participate. As we talk about the influence of money in politics, does the way the system works now, and you've heard some differing views here this morning about that, does it influence the amount of trust that you have in the way our political system operates? I'd like you to think about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, John Nichols from The Nation, Joe Yuzinski from the University of Miami, back with us on the other side of news. We're also going to talk about, we mentioned government financing, public financing for campaigns. We'll also talk about some of the solutions. I'm wondering if more transparency around donations to PACs is enough, opening up the details on who's contributing to some of these soft money organizations. So we'll talk about that as well, all on the other side of news. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Hi, Carrie. After dismissing questions about her health as little more than a conspiracy theory, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton is now sidelined for a couple of days to recover from pneumonia. Clinton has canceled a West Coast campaign trip. Clinton abruptly left a 9/11 anniversary ceremony yesterday, and a video showed her being held up by three people as she was helped into a van. Her opponent, Donald Trump, says he will release more information about his own health. The top four congressional leaders come calling at the White House this afternoon to have conversations with President Obama about plans to keep the government funded and open for business. The government funding bill is the only must-pass piece of legislation ahead of the November election. An air of mistrust exists as a ceasefire brokered by the U.S. and Russia is set to begin shortly in Syria. The deal allows the Syrian government to continue to strike at Islamic extremist forces until the U.S. and Russia take over the task in a week. Rebel factions have expressed deep reservations about the plan. China says tension and conflict on the Korean Peninsula is the fault of the U.S. It's Beijing's response to international calls that it needs to do more to rein in North Korea's nuclear program. A Chinese foreign ministry spokeswoman cited a Chinese saying, whoever started the trouble should end it. Experts say the North might conduct another nuclear test. And an early morning fire in Memphis killed 9 people, including 5 children. Authorities say another child is hospitalized in critical condition. The Memphis Fire Department says a family of 10 lived in the house. It's not clear what started the fire or if the home had a working smoke detector. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:42.
Every day on All Things Considered, surprising perspectives on the news of the day.
I think there's been a lot of hypocrisy on this, and oddly enough, I kind of welcome it.
I'm Tom Crane. Join me for analysis that goes well beyond the headlines. Weekdays on Minnesota Public Radio News, starting at 3.
If you have to get to that meeting or go run that errand, you can't listen for the full hour. We get that. That's why every conversation we have, including all of these political conversations, are on the podcast. How to find it? Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes. Programming is supported by MacPhail Music for Life, lessons designed for adults 55 plus, offering instrument and voice lessons for absolute beginner through experienced musician. Information and registration at MacPhail.org.
I have a feeling we'll be talking a fair amount about politics when Jeff Toobin is with me at the Westminster Town Hall Forum. It's September 28th, talking about his new book about the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. But yeah, he comments a lot on politics on CNN, so that'll be part of the conversation as well. It's free. How often does that happen? Westminster Town Hall Forum, September 28th. Back to the conversation this hour. John Nichols with us from The Nation, Joe Yuzinski with us from the University of Miami, as we talk about the influence of money and politics. And Joe, a listener called in to say, the professor you have is touting money as speech. The obvious equivalency here is the more money you have, the more speech you have. I don't think, she says, this is what the founders intended. What would you say to that?
I have no idea to know what the founders intended because they lived a couple hundred years ago. And even if they were in my office right now, I could not get into their minds to see their intentions. So that's sort of an argument that I push aside. Money existed then, and they had their negotiations to write the Constitution in secret, partially because they didn't want, they knew what the influence of all the different interests were that they were representing. And there have been careful analyses done of the votes that were taken, by our founders, and it finds, interests matter. Particularly, if you're from Carolina, you're going to support things that Carolina wanted at the time. If you're from the North, you're going to support things that are from the North. So interests matter. I'm not sure why it's okay to draw a distinction and say, well, if you're from a district that has an industry in it, it's okay to vote for whatever they want, but other districts should vote for the common good. Whether it's you're being influenced by money or being influenced by votes to do something wrong, it's still wrong, right? So I think one thing we got to ask ourselves is if we take away money in the way that some people are suggesting, mm-hmm. how different would the world be? Would it really be that different? I understand there would be some influences, but we're acting as if, most voters are in the middle class. We're acting as if they're angels, that somehow the rich people are rich and they just do evil things to create more inequality and take money from themselves and make people starve. Like they're all Mr. Burns from The Simpsons.
Uh-huh.
But is the middle class a bunch of angels? I mean, I'm a middle class person. I come from a, middle class family. I don't see us wanting to vote, to pay more taxes to help somebody else.
John,
and most people don't want to do that. Most people want to pay for programs that will help them.
John,
question I would ask is what programs that do you want to take away that help the middle class right now? Because they're a special interest, too.
John, how different would it be without the kind of money we're talking?
It would be wildly different. We know
would have a very different healthcare system in this country and a much more functional one, one that would provide healthcare easily at lower cost to more people with better results. These are simple realities. This is not something I'm saying. It's something that, you know, you couldn't get through the piles of studies that have shown us this. The influence of money on our politics is incredibly damaging. It's damaging in the electoral process. It's damaging in the governing process. And the interesting thing is, and I really appreciate Joe's brilliant comment that he can't get into the minds of the founders. That's exactly right. And none of us should try to. What we should try to do is recognize their genius. They wrote a constitution, and then they said, but you know what's really important about this? We can amend it. You know, and Jefferson and Madison and founder after founder said, you know, look, you don't want to lock people into a certain moment. You're going to have to adapt over time. You're going to recognize the challenges that come to a country if you just, you know, live in a constitution that's 200 and some years old. You're going to end up in a situation where governance and politics become unresponsive. They don't function. And there were clearly fears at the founding. We know that. It's been written about. You don't have to go into people's minds that elites would come together, forming factions that would serve themselves.
So
we have the ability to amend the Constitution of the United States. We should amend it to say that money isn't speech. Corporations aren't people. And we, the people, the great mass of us, have a right to organize elections through, you know, through political processes, legislative processes, to organize elections in which our votes always matter more than the dollars that are forced into the process.
So, Joe, that's rolling back the Supreme Court decision or legislating around the Supreme Court decision on Citizens United and more. What about that?
Well, I don't want to get into the minds of the founding fathers again, but I will say that money is used in campaigns to buy speech. So for those purposes, it is speech. They're not purchasing votes and they're not purchasing wins. They're purchasing speech. And in the First Amendment of the Constitution, if we want to get into the minds of Madison or other founders, that's number one. And they always felt, you know, in their writings, they expressed this, that political speech was incredibly important. And to put that into the hands of the government was probably not a good thing. That's one of the reasons why they started their own country, is to make sure that government didn't have complete control over political speech. Now, I understand that every system is going to have its problems and its unintended externalities, and that's fine. The question is, you know, given that we are always going to have a system in which some people and institutions are more powerful than others, how do we want that system to have the power divided? Do we want government to have all the power, or do we want it to be split among many different interests who are all spending money, sometimes with each other, oftentimes against each other, or do we want to have it all concentrated in the government?
Yeah,
and I am willing to accept some problems from this system just to keep government from having a monopoly on political speech.
When you laid that out, when you said, you know, how do we want it to be, it almost makes it sound as if, yes, the certain parts of the pie are all equal. We have all these interests and they fight. The problem is that that's not true and it's very lopsided. And that's what we have today.
And it would be even more lopsided if there was only one entity that spent money on political speech.
The government?
Yes.
John?
I disagree. Well, I certainly don't disagree that if it was only one entity, if it was government, you know, or if it was just corporations, which is unfortunately in many circumstances much closer to what we have. Look, the bottom line is this. In the United States of America, we have the ability to organize a system that is fair and functional. We know this from other countries. Amusingly enough, we know it from what we have done historically. When we have had strict campaign finance laws, when we have had precisely the sort of regulations that Joe worries about, including public funding in different states and in different regions around this country, we haven't ended up with some totalitarian, one-party rule, horrible situation, the worst of all scenarios. We've actually had transfers of power, parties winning, going left and right, based on the realities of the moment. What we have now with a money-drenched system is a politics and a governance that does not respond to the realities of the moment. It doesn't do logical things. Remember in 2008, we had the meltdown of the global economy. I accept that you needed to stabilize the banks to some extent, but with all due respect, the response of our government to the meltdown of the global economy and to a host of huge challenges for working Americans, including, you know, the challenge of paying for their homes, was we got to make sure that the bankers are whole, right? We got to protect them. We aren't going to prosecute any of them. We're not going to hold them to account. We're just going to take care of them, flood money into them, and hope things work out for everybody else. I will promise you right now, Carrie, the reason that we have the churn in our politics today in 2016, 8 years later, is because tremendous numbers of Americans saw that, and they were horrified. What they realized is that their governance responded immediately and fully to the power of bankers and Wall Street's and wealthy donors, and it did not respond to them.
Michael says on Twitter, simply stated, people in large organizations do not donate money to politicians because it does nothing. The payoff is assured. And to Margaret in Woodbury. Hi, Margaret. Thanks for waiting.
Sure.
What are you thinking about here?
Well, this is an anecdotal kind of point. But,
sure.
I was at a party gathering of people. People who are involved in the political process and supporting candidates, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Some of them are able to give more than we're able to, but we're talking about the whole process. And the ones that are at kind of that level, they have relationships with the representatives, et cetera. But what they're blown away by is how much time the people they know in politics spend raising money now. It's a cycle in and of itself. It's just about the money. So if they're spending time raising money, they're not spending time doing the job they're elected to do. So, it's the process. I mean, they were all kind of flummoxed on a solution because that's just the way it exists now. The number of calls they get, the number of activities that the legislators themselves are doing to just do fundraisers, it's not about doing the job they're sent there for.
I appreciate the call. Thank you. Joe, a listener just tweeted me something that I missed here in the Atlantic. This is kind of interesting. It's about an experiment that Seattle is doing with campaign fundraising. Do you know about this, or campaign funding, I should say?
No.
Okay, so here's what the article says. In Seattle, voters just approved a system that flips the approach on its head. Starting in 2017, city residents will be able to contribute to local candidates without spending a dime of their own money. Instead, the government will send each registered voter four $25 vouchers that they can give to candidates of their choice. No cutting a check, no minimum contribution. Candidates can opt out, but those who participate will have to abide by strict limits on spending and on receiving private donations. What do you think of the idea of that at first blush?
Well, it does solve one problem, right, in that you're putting the choice of who to give the money to into the hands of the voters, right?
Right, right.
On the other hand, if I'm a resident there, it's taking away my choice of whether I want to pay for that or not.
You mean just as a voter or a citizen of Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, they just can't put vouchers on funny money and give it to people. The money has to come from
somewhere. They're using taxpayer money for that. Yeah.
It's out of my pocket, and I'm being forced to now fund political speech.
Well, as you are being forced to abide by all kinds of things that the city council decides is good for the common good, as representatives of those residents, right?
Sure, but that doesn't mean I should pay for everything.
John, here's the executive director of a Seattle-based think tank who says the promise of vouchers is turning every single voter in the city into a donor. What do you think of the idea of this?
Well, I think it's one of many attempts to address this issue, and you know, you also allow people to donate through their taxes, create a pool of money voluntarily. People don't always do that, and I think in general because they don't like to pay taxes, among other things. But you know, here's the core of this that I think is really important. When Joe says, oh, you know, we don't want the government to pay for everything, I generally agree. I think there's a bunch of things the government shouldn't pay for. But that's rooted in who I am. That's rooted in my politics. It's rooted in my religious values, my ideology, my personal upbringing. And I still pay my taxes. I accept a whole bunch of things that I don't necessarily like because it's part of living in a civil society.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question is, what would we like to pay for first? Myself, I'd like to pay for a functional democracy. I'd like to, first and foremost, pay for a democracy where our elections are not defined or at least influenced heavily by money from people who do not care about my community. They don't care about me. They care about their own self-interest. Now, I may vote on my own self-interest. I accept all that. But what I'm saying is, if you can set up a system that democratizes donations to politics, I mean, essentially makes people equal in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
If you can set up a system that decreases the influence of big money in a way that is disproportional and unequal, I think that's kind of the first thing you want to pay for in a functional civil society. Now, you may put, I would argue, certainly the defense of the society, the safety of the society, as, you know, kind of a baseline. Yes, you have to do that. But boy, when you start to have elective choices, you know, democracy, I'm going to go for that. Yep.
John, I really appreciate the time and the insight, as always. Thanks so much. John Nichols is the author of Dollarocracy. Joe, I have about a minute and a half for a response.
Well, we should not think for a moment that our government does not respond to middle and lower class people. We spend, you know, tons and tons of money, and we have lots of programs that are paid for by the wealthy and go directly to middle class and lower class people. When we're talking about food stamps, we have food stamps, we have Social Security, we have Medicaid, we have Medicare, we have all sorts of programs out there that aren't for the wealthy 1%. They're for middle class people. Even if you take away the bias that's induced into our elections by the wealthy class, you're still stuck with a democracy of people who don't always know what they want, they don't always agree, and they always want to spend more than they pay in taxes. And a lot of our gridlock is due to just people, our country, not being able to agree on what they want to do, and it's not because of money. It's because it's democracy, and people don't always know the best thing.
Joe, really glad you could come back and join us again for a good conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe Uzinski from the University of Miami, and he is the author of a book titled American Conspiracy Theories.